And of course, we're going to take your phone calls this hour with Dr. Diane Hennessy-Powell as we talk about psychic abilities, share a story, or even a question when we come back. Welcome back, Dr. Diane Hennessy-Powell with us. We're going to take your calls. Diane, we were talking a little bit about animals and their GPS built-in system and stuff. Why can't humans have that?
Or do maybe we do. Maybe we do. You know, it's interesting when you look at the remote viewing experiments that were done at SRI, the ones that were done with Inglis Swann, they used geographic coordinates, you know, for the remote viewing, you know, and so that's a lot like a GPS.
Well, it is a lot like a GPS, but in your research, I mean, are you convinced that consciousness is outside of the body?
Well, you know, I think that it's really, let me put it this way. That's an assumption to assume that consciousness is in the body. That's a huge assumption.
That's right.
Yeah, and so I think that there's a lot of evidence for consciousness being outside of the body, absolutely. One of the questions that people ask me about with telepathy, I mean, does that prove that consciousness is outside the body? No, not necessarily. Telepathy doesn't necessarily prove that. But I think that things like near-death experiences, and there have been a lot of those that have been, you know, in the news lately. There was a person who had a 45-minute, he was dead for 45
minutes. He was dead, yeah.
Yeah, and then came back. When you have those kinds of things happen, or the stories of reincarnation, you know, those kinds of stories are very interesting stories.
I mean, some of them are so compelling. It is hard not to accept that.
Right. Yeah.
We'll go to some of the calls here for you as they line up for you. We'll go to Richmond, Virginia. First of all, Phil is with us. Hey, Phil, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks, George. First-time caller.
Great.
Dr. Diane, I had a couple questions for you.
Yes.
Back in 2000, I was in the active duty Air Force, and I was diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder. Since then, I've been treated and medicated and everything like that, pretty well stabilized. But my questions are this. I've been tested twice for IQ test. The first one came to be a score of 50, which would put me in the mentally handicapped range. And they said, we don't believe this applies to you. You're high functioning, and, you know, I was in the military for crying out loud. So, anyhow, they test me. I wasn't tested again by the military, but I was tested by the Department of Rehabilitative Services here in Virginia. And they didn't give me a score, but they said my score set me in the 7th percentile of my age group. I've also experienced some of the symptoms you've described for having extra perception, as far as just having dreams and waking into that reality. I don't know the best way of describing it other than that.
I've got a question here, Philip. You want a question?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Sure.
No, you give us one.
Are these things symptoms of what you're describing, or would this be something totally separate?
Are you asking me if what you've experienced is similar to what I'm talking about?
Yes.
It sounds like it could be, very much so. So one of the things that you're telling me is that you've your IQ went from being 50 or so to being a very high IQ. Is that correct?
I assume he jumped. Go ahead.
And so what do you attribute that increase in your IQ to?
is an increase. They said it was a decrease. I have no clue.
You're saying that you had a decrease in your IQ.
That was the impression it gave me.
I see. I see. Okay, I misunderstood you. Okay. So what is your question exactly then? I'm not quite clear on what your question is. Are you saying that you had a decrease in your IQ and you're having extrasensory experiences now? Is that
it? Well, I've had the extrasensory experiences almost all my life.
I see. Okay. Okay.
And it doesn't matter if I'm medicated or not.
Well, but a low IQ based on being a savant, Diane, if I understand it correctly, is common, right?
Well, okay. One of the misconceptions people have about the savants is that their IQ can be anywhere. A lot of them are geniuses. And so their IQ can be anywhere from severely mentally retarded all the way up to, you know, very, very high IQ. So that's one of the misconceptions about people who are mentally retarded. But one of the things about IQ is that there's a lot of problems with that kind of testing. You know, so, you know, I don't really, you know, put a lot of stock in a lot of IQ testing. Your diagnosis that you said of schizoaffective disorder is interesting for me, because one of the things that I'm interested in is that the way that psychiatry is today, that people who have, you know, people really do legitimately have extrasensory perceptions, and they tell a psychiatrist, they're going to get labeled with something like schizoaffective disorder or schizophrenia. That's the way that the diagnoses go. And it's not until these things are validated and proven as being legitimate phenomenon that they'll stop being, you know, put a label on as being pathology, because I think that some of these things are, you know, are actually skills. So I don't know if you were given a label of schizoaffective disorder just because you have these abilities.
A little quick update on Ferguson. 29 people arrested tonight. Let's go to Henry, who happens to be in St. Louis. Henry, go ahead.
Hi, George. How you doing? Thank you very much. Thank you for your guest. My only question is this. Can we possibly even look into the future of even thinking that there will be funds that will be structured for this, either through the private sector? Because we look at the government sector, and there's so much funds being cut for mental health programs and everything else. Is this something that'll even basically get off the ground at all?
Well, thank you for asking that question. You know, that's one of the reasons why I'm trying to do, because I'm really trying to do a scientific revolution here. I'm really trying to change the paradigm. And I've been doing it. I work as a psychiatrist during the day, and I do this research, you know, on my off hours. And so I've started a crowdfunding campaign so that if people just pitch in, and it's called the Telepathy Project. It's an Indiegogo campaign. And you can see some video of this girl doing her telepathy experiments. And if people fund this, you know, then, you know, we can take back science, because science is not, the science we're interested in isn't getting funded in this country. And you're right, and mental health is not getting properly funded in this country. Our priorities are wrong.
Yeah, they sure are. Can you honestly say that this ability is in all of us? We just have to enhance it?
Obviously you can't say, you know, for sure that it's in everyone, but it appears to be something that's innate. And the reason why I say it's innate is because of the fact that so many people have reported it across time, you know, across cultures. It's something that that a child, it's not just autistic children that have, you know, this ability. Rupert Sheldrake's studying other children. It's just that they show it to the degree where you go, you can't deny it anymore. I mean, when you have a child give you 155 out of 162 digits
yeah.
correct in 10 minutes,
right,
and then gets the other seven correct on the second try, the odds of that are so off the chart.
Or they sit down and play Mozart or something.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, it's playing, yeah, playing Mozart, you know, that's one of the things is that, you know, some of these children who have these musical gifts, you know, sometimes it's like, how'd they acquire that, you know? And how'd they acquire that ability? And, you know, I think that, you know, that's worth studying, but that's a different phenomenon than this child who's exhibiting, you know, just pure telepathy.
It's amazing work that you've been doing. How long have you been at this now?
Oh, I've been doing it for over 10 years.
It's a long time. I bet you have some strange psychiatric stories too, don't you, as a doctor?
Oh, of course. Yes, yes. Just when you think that you've heard everything, then you'll hear something else.
and of course, you know, between the doctor-patient relationship, there's things you cannot say. But have you ever had somebody in a psychiatric evaluation or what have you that you felt was truly out of it and there was nothing you could do to fix that?
Yeah, I must admit. Yeah, you occasionally see people that
they're just so whacked out.
Yeah. Mhm. Yeah, that there's really not much you can do. Yeah. But at the same time, I really don't give up on people, and I've been able to help the majority of the people that I've seen.
What do you think would have happened to them in their life and their childhood to get them to this point?
Well, it depends upon what way of being whacked out you're talking about.
Yeah.
So if you give me an example, like, is there someone that you have in mind that you wonder, like, what would make someone be like that?
Well, you know, like serial killers, for example. Why do they do what they do? Why do they get some enjoyment out of that? Is that something that's been created when they were kids?
Oh, yeah. You know, that's an interesting question about serial killers. There was a recent psychiatric journal of mine that discussed serial killers, people like Jeffrey Dahmer and people like that. And
yeah.
And what's really, you know, kind of shocking about it is that a lot of them, what lies behind it is that they're profoundly lonely. And the only way that they can be around people is when they're dead.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Because the dead don't argue with them or anything else.
That's right. And Jeffrey Dahmer tried to keep these corpses, you know, around and eat dinner with them, you know, sitting at the table. I mean, you know, it was like his pretend friends.
No, but was he created as a kid that something happened to him?
Oh, he definitely something must have happened to him. I don't know his story, you know, but definitely people don't. Something
is not right.
Horrible. Yeah, something is totally not right with him. Yeah. And you know, and it's one of those things where, you know, he couldn't relate with people, you know.
If you were to look at his brain, do you think you would see something abnormal?
Oftentimes you do in people that are that, yes, oftentimes people that disturbed. Like, for example, people who have absolutely no conscience at all, you know, that just are total sociopaths, they frequently will have a part of their brain, it's in the frontotemporal area, that is, you know, it's like you see a hole in their, you know, there, that it's a part of their brain that really didn't develop. And there's a critical window of time during development for people to develop certain, you know, like to develop a moral conscience and to develop empathy, you know. And so that's part of the problem of, you know, people growing up in these, you know, horrible situations where they don't have anyone who's a safe harbor. Some things people have to experience it to help them to develop them themselves.
Let's go east of the Rockies. Herb is with us in Big Springs, Texas. Hi, Herb. Welcome to the program.
Hi, George and Doctor. I appreciate you taking my call.
You're very welcome.
To relay an experience I had, 54 years ago when I was 7, laying back in bed and just thinking about different abstract items and and I wondered why I was me or why I was here. And it was really a deep thought for a seven-year-old. And something happened. It's hard to explain, but all this information just started flowing into me. I mean, it was like I could do brain surgery or fix anything in the world I wanted to. And it was such an influx of information that was so fast and so furious, it actually hurt. And I had to grab my head and pull away from it. And I don't know if you've ever had anybody experience that before, but I've never wanted to try it again.
and it was don't just try so this at home, huh?
It was hard to describe.
I've heard other people describe that sort of phenomenon. It's really interesting, you know, where they get flooded with information. It's like you're just downloading information.
Sometimes too much information?
Yeah, and that's one of the things with these autistic children. One of the, you know, theories about, you know, why they, you know, have so many difficulties is that they can't filter out information, that they get too much, you know, and that, you know, it would drive anybody, you know, bonkers if you were getting that much information all the time.
That sure would. Well, I got to tell you, though, Diane, it has been a remarkable journey, I think, for a lot of people who study ESP, who've been part of ESP, who have that ability, and It's a wonderful gift, I think, don't you?
Yeah, it's a mixed blessing for some people. But you know, I think that it is a tremendous that these people, these children, for example, that I'm talking about, they have so many gifts. You know, they really do. Some of these children, that there's this little boy that I evaluated in India, and he wants to do physics. He wants to solve physics problems. And so these children who can, you know, that seemingly download information, and if they want to, you know, solve a lot of these problems of the world, you know, let's give them a chance to do that. But unfortunately, people aren't putting the resources into it. I mean, that's one of the, I'm actually founding a nonprofit institute for autism and communication specifically to help them with this kind of thing.
All right. Well, we're going to take this break. We're going to come back. But Diane, if you would please give out your website.
It's DianeHenesePowell.com, and that's DianeHenesePowell.com.
And if people want to email you with other questions, can they get to you through the website?
Yes, they can get to me through the website.
Okay, and the name of the book is The ESP Enigma, The Scientific Case for Psychic Phenomena. And we're going to come back with Diane Hennessy-Powell and wrap things up and take final calls in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to talk about one of the world's foremost experts on Sherlock Holmes, Dracula, Leslie Klinger. We'll be talking about H.P. Lovecraft, so make sure you're part of that show. We're coming back in a moment with Dr. Diane Hennessy-Powell and final phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Diane Hennessy-Powell with us. Is it difficult for you to play the role of psychiatrist during the day and a paranormal psychiatrist during the night?
well, it's difficult from the standpoint that I'd love to spend more time doing this research, and it really slows me down, the fact that I'm funding it by doing my psychiatry practice. So that's why I started the philosophy project. So I hope people go to my website and check it out, or go to Indiegogo and check it out. Because
why don't you go to like Kickstarter or something?
Well, that's what Indiegogo is. It's like Kickstarter. The difference between them is that Kickstarter is it doesn't work with nonprofits, and it's also all or nothing. And Indiegogo, it allows for flexible funding.
Ah, I like it. Okay, Martin in Atlanta, Georgia. Martin, take it away. Welcome to the program.
First of all, I wanted to know how is, as an autistic adult who has psychic abilities, be able to participate in your research?
You mean if somebody has those abilities, how can they contact me to participate? You can contact me through my website if you know of anybody.
It's actually myself. I have a real brief story where a few years ago I had a premonition where a friend of mine was going to be paralyzed in a car accident, and it actually verbally came out of my mouth, and I prayed for her protection and found out later that she actually had a flat tire driving about 55 miles an hour and was all right. And I had a umption to check her Facebook page. I'm like, why do I need to check her Facebook page if I just checked it previously, like maybe 30 minutes before, and saw how she posted how she ended up not having an accident after having the flat tire driving on the highway to high speed.
Yeah, and have you had any other premonitions like that? That's pretty remarkable.
He's gone. He's gone. He's off to have his own premonition. How accurate would you say these people are?
Well, I mean, I think that Haley, I mean, from what the therapists who know her really well and the parents say, she's 100% accurate when she's totally focused.
100%? That's absolutely staggering.
It is. It is. But that's what they told me. Now, my data, I have areas where she's 100%, but, you know, for the first half an hour, she's, 30-50% because she was acclimating to having cameras there and a divider between her and the therapist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so in autistic children in general have difficulty acclimating to change. You know, it takes them a while to adjust to it because it's, as I said, they're overstimulated to begin with, and you add new things in there, and it's really hard for them. So I was just really pleased with the footage I was able to get at the time. I just was amazed that she was able to do that. I just was there for 3 days, and I was able to get the kind of data I just described.
What kind of accuracy would a person have who was not a savant, not artistic, but just normal in terms of, their abilities?
I mean, I assume, were to put you through the same kind of test?
Well, me particularly, I'm very psychic, Diane.
Okay.
I mean, somebody who really wasn't, would they score extremely low?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They'd score a chance, you know. And so, for example, when Haley was doing the numbers, you know, for each one of those numbers that she got correct, the chances of her getting it correct was 1 out of 10 because there's 10 digits.
That's right.
And so when to do the statistics on that, if she did 155 correct in a row, then that's 1 over 10 times itself 155 times. That's the chances out. That's what it is. It's 1 out of 10 to the 155th power.
That this is just chance
that she could do that. That's just unbelievably staggering.
Sure is. Shirley's in Iowa. You're up with us. Go ahead, Shirley.
Yes, I'd like to know. I have a daughter who is tested when she was only in fifth grade, and they thought she was autistic.
Uh-huh.
Now, they tested her and found she wasn't. She's a genius in computers.
Mm-hmm.
Her teacher said, if somebody doesn't send her in when she got to senior high school, she's a senior. He says, if they don't send her to college, I'm going to send her to college. The teacher never, I don't know what happened to the teacher, kind of like he floated out of nowhere. But that was out of Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And, at Kennedy High School, he said, yeah, she's very gifted. Well, she can make anything. She's a perfectionist at everything she does. And I'm a perfectionist, and that's what I'm wondering. Is it carrying on from the DNA to her? Is it going to carry on to her baby? Because she's going to have a child, and she's 5 months along. I'd like to know.
Yeah. That's a good question. I mean, it very well could, you know, carry on to her child. I mean, they... you know, the autism, it's interesting that you say, was she diagnosed with autism and she outgrew the autism? Because some children, actually about 20% of children can outgrow the autism. Now, a lot of people don't realize that. Yeah, and oftentimes it's because they have food allergies.
No.
And, yeah, yeah. And
I've never thought of that.
Yeah, a lot of them
gluten
have food
foods,
allergies.
Diane.
And if you put them on an organic diet and remove all of this processed food, their symptoms go away.
That's what I have on right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's green.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
She's doing very well.
Uh-huh.
She's about 31 years old, and this is her first baby.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So
but,
I'm excited.
Well, that is exciting. The genius can stay, you know, and the autism can go. The genius doesn't depend upon the autism. So, I'd like to take the opportunity to say that, you know, a lot of people don't realize autism has increased in incidence about 350-fold.
What's the cause for that?
Three generations.
How come?
That's a very good question. There was no such thing as autism before 1938. That's when it was first described by Leo Kanner at Johns Hopkins. And back in 1970, it was an incidence of 1 in 25,000. Now it's 1 in 68 children. And it's worldwide.
1 in 68?
Yes.
Jeez.
Yes, 1 in 68. And so something's going on, and if you think about it, and so people talk about, you know, nobody's equivocating over whether it's increasing. They're just arguing over what's causing it. But when you think about it going from never being seen, and then it goes from that to being 1 in 68 children. In South Korea, it's reportedly 1 in 38. Now, some of that is that they've broadened the criteria for autism. So you have some children being diagnosed as autistic now that would not have been diagnosed as autistic before. That's definitely some of it. But a lot of it is that something's happening. You know, some of it is genetic mutations. There are so many genes that code for the brain that you could have a genetic mutation in a lot of different places and still get something that looks like autism. And so a lot of these kids just are lumped together all as autism. But some of them, it's a genetic mutation. Some of them, I actually, you know, it's a food sensitivity. And so if you think about how many things we've introduced to our environment since World War II, and then you look at the incidence of autism, you can see that, you know, we've introduced something into our environment. We've introduced a lot of things into our environment. And something's causing it that's unnatural.
Well, what about, mercury poisoning and stuff like that? Does that affect it?
Well, mercury's been around for a long time, and mercury doesn't cause autism. I mean, it can cause Mad Hatter syndrome. It can cause people to have a different kind of insanity. But and autism is, this is the other thing, is that some of these children who are labeled autistic, when I've met with the speech-language therapist, you know, they've said that not all of these kids, when you finally teach them how to express themselves, they no longer, you realize that they're not really what people think they are. They're not really autistic. Their language is fully intact. That what they actually have is a neurological problem that doesn't allow them to know how to use their mouth and their vocal apparatus or their digits to communicate, and they get lumped into the same, you know, category as other kids, and yet they're a fully intelligent, sensitive human being. You know,
do they show emotion, Diane?
Oh, absolutely.
They do, huh?
And oftentimes their emotion is that they're pissed off because they get treated like they're idiots when they're not.
If you were to MRI their brain, would you see anything different?
Yeah. That one of the things is that their brains have a lot of differences in them, and so I think that's been once again another reason why, you know, there's so much mystery about autism, because so many kids are being lumped, you know, together as autistic that are suffering from, I think, a variety of different things. The ones that I'm interested in, though, all fit a very specific pattern, and they're these children that are nonverbal, or they develop language very late, and they have they're very obsessive compulsive, so they have, you know, OCD, and they, you know, so they have repetitive movements of their hands.
Right.
And those children are the ones that are the ones that exhibit the telepathy in my experience.
The, compulsive disorder, what causes that?
That's a part of the brain that, that's actually one of the first psychiatric conditions for which they were able to identify a section of the brain that's overactive. And there's a part of the brain that's overactive, and what we call it in psychiatry is we call it pathological doubt. And so people with obsessive compulsive disorder, they have a hard time being reassured about something. So whatever it is, if their OCD is about germs, they have a hard time feeling reassured that they've washed their hands enough times, say.
Now, here's mine. Tell me, this is my free psychiatric session, right?
Mm-hmm.
I have to replace burned out light bulbs if I see them burned out. I don't like it if a light is there with a burned out bulb. Mm-hmm. I even go nuts if I'm driving by a store, says Ralph's and the R is out.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Uh-huh. What causes that? Come on, lay it out. Tell me.
Well, what it is so it's similar to me to in a way to the people that I had a patient once who was an architect, and he would take his he had a level that he would use to plot, a level that you use to make sure that something's perfectly straight, and he would use it to make sure all of his pictures in his house were straight, that kind of needing that something. So similarly, like if something is wrong, so for him, something being a little crooked is wrong, or a light bulb being out is wrong. It creates a sense of something's wrong. It creates it's called pathological doubt, because it's like you there's something, you get a discomfort inside of you from something. And you just feel better if you just fix it.
I like fixing things,
Yeah, exactly. You just feel better if you fix it. It reduces a little bit of this disease that you feel inside.
Let's go to Marion in the state of Washington, west of the Rockies. Hi, Marion. Go ahead.
Hi. I just want to say first, before I ask questions, that this is very exciting. I'm so glad that Diane is doing what she's doing, so that more, not only the result she's going for, but so more people will see these people with so-called handicaps as not just needful, but contributing to our world, because I think that's why they're really here, and that's been greatly overlooked. And I think you're asking great questions, George, and I really thank you for this.
Oh, you're welcome. That's
right. Thank you. Thanks for your comments. I agree.
I have a few questions, but also I realize I can email you, so if there isn't time, I'm fine with that. The first was because I've done work with autism and Down syndrome and other mentally challenged people, and I worked mostly with using movement and arts therapies,
mm-hmm.
but mostly, I've been independently trained and educated with teachers that were in the field that I chose to study with, rather than getting a degree at a college in what I did.
Uh-huh.
So I never really did it officially or charged anything except for some donations. But I have extensive experience, and I'm writing about it. And one of my questions it relates to, there's an autistic young man that I've done some studies with, and he can't talk yet. I'm going to see if he might be eligible for your study.
Huh. How old is he?
I think he's in his late 20s, but
Wow. But
I think he's very psychic, and I'm excited. It's hard for me to talk right now because I'm very excited, because I think I'm getting some information from this talk that I really needed to understand what I'm doing. because I think a lot of my work was happening on a subconscious level, because I had amazing results with people that nobody, not medical doctors, not psychiatrists, not other kinds of therapists, could get any results with.
All right, Marion, let's let her get her comments here, because we're almost out of time. And her website, of course, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com, where you can email her. So what causes someone who's up there in age who can't talk like this?
You mean what? That's part of the syndrome, is that people with autism, that a lot of them have this severe language delay.
They do. Okay. And when a child is born, and, gets to be 1 month, 2 months, Can a parent recognize that they might be autistic?
It's hard in the first month. It's really hard in the first month. But I would say that what you don't see is the typical social smile, you know, in an autistic child, you know, at the time when they start smiling.
Right.
They don't babble,
yeah.
You know. So babbling is actually our play, you know, our early attempts at language, you know, is babbling, you know, and autistic children don't babble like we do. But a lot of parents aren't, that they may be crying, but they don't babble.
That's a good point. You've studied this a lot, haven't you?
Yes. I know what I'm talking about, yes.
have there been any pitfalls for you or any down points here that just didn't work out for you?
You mean, in what sense do you mean? You mean
in doing some of your research, have you hit some roadblocks?
Oh, yeah. Well, roadblocks only in the sense that, you know, the medical board, the medical board where I practice questioned my sanity because I wrote a book with ESP in the title. And so I...
Uh-huh. That's right. I wonder what they think of me then, right?
don't go there.
All right. We're almost out of time, Diane. Once again, give out your website, please.
It's DianeHennacyPowell.com. And when people go there, they'll see a purple button that says Telepathy Project. And if they click on the text underneath that, they'll be able to, it'll take them right to my crowdfunding campaign, which is like a Kickstarter campaign. And they'll be able to see some video. They'll be able to see me some video. And they'll be able to read. I have a lot of information in there about this child and some of the other children.
Fantastic. Thank you, Diane. I appreciate you being on the program. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borles, George Knapp, Art Bell, and Tim Banal. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.